Comics podcast. I'm your host Adam, and with me as always is my co-host Jordan. Jordan, how's it going?
Hey, how's it going, Adam? As of the release of this episode, we are 126 days away from Bruce Wayne and Selina Kyle's wedding. I'm gonna start announcing that at the top of each of our episodes, how many days. I know that sounds like a lot right now, but Batman number 50 is it'll be right around the corner before we know it, so I can't wait. Tom King just recently shared a photo, an image of Selina in her wedding dress, or at least a tease of it. I can't wait. So I'm doing great, Adam, to answer your question. How are you doing, man?
That's your desktop background, isn't it?
It is not, actually. I've got my desktop background is still the Batcat kiss from episode 3 of Batman: The Enemy Within. So the one in costume, not the one in the Batcave. So.
I'm sure you'll change it accordingly as we get closer. This is not a Batcat episode, but we are. It is episode 24 of the podcast, and we are getting back to our Superman film reviews. And to do that, we've got a special guest. We are joined by Chris Clow. Many of our listeners will probably know him. He's been affiliated, I believe still is, with Batman on Film in some respect. Is that correct, Chris?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was my first home. So whenever they ask me to come back for something, it's not hard to say absolutely yes.
Okay, so you don't fluctuate like Ben Affleck does with decisions. Whether you're coming or going.
No.
Or, okay, good. It's good to have you here, Chris. And I want to say I was... I believe I was listening to one of your Star Trek Discovery podcasts.
Oh, thank you.
And for whatever reason, you started talking about Superman. And I'm like, well, he's a really big fan of Superman. I really want to talk to him about Superman. So that's what sort of brought this first appearance on the show, hopefully of many more, about. And so we're glad to have you.
I appreciate it, man. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. Really... A significant amount of stuff that I've talked about has oriented itself around Superman. So really, I feel right at home talking about the Man of Steel.
So now, would that be fair to say that he is your favorite DC character?
You know, it fluctuates based on the day. I have often called Batman my favorite character in all of fiction. But really, my love of Superman is strong enough that, you know, on a day that ends in Y, you could ask me and I could change my answer between Batman and Superman. But those two are at the absolute top for me.
I'm in a similar boat where it really depends on the day I'm having. You know, if my day's gone not so well, and I'm feeling kind of angry and, you know, I want to just lash out and punch something, then Batman's my go-to mood. So it'll be Batman on one day, and then the next day, if I'm having a really good mood and things are going smoothly, I'm happy and cheerful, and I feel very Superman centered. So it fluctuates as well for me. Jordan, we know, loves Superman too, but Batman is his top tier. Guys,
absolutely.
That's where we are. Because we're doing a Superman, what I usually do with our guests, Chris, is depending on what exactly we're talking about, I'll ask them who their favorite character is and what their favorite movie is in regards to the universe. So because we're doing Superman, I'll ask you, who is your favorite Superman actor and what is your favorite live action Superman movie?
Christopher Reeve, Superman the movie. It's a pretty easy call for me. I mean, I was a guy who was extremely anticipatory for Man of Steel. But there are aspects of Man of Steel that I don't feel emphasized enough of modern Superman.
Okay.
But Really, I think Justice League got pretty close, and I was really happy with how Superman was portrayed in Justice League. But, I mean, when it comes to just, like, the definitive... Really, Superman the movie was the progenitor of modern superhero film. I don't think that there's really any debating that. Everything that we understand in the genre of comics-based cinema and superhero cinema originated with Superman the movie, and really... It was also the prototype for what effective superhero casting looks like, because Christopher Reeve, who wasn't particularly well known before he put the cape on, he was able to embody that character in a way that we've only ever seen in comic book cinema a few times. I mean, I put Hugh Jackman as Wolverine in a similar category. I think that that casting is nearly perfect. But really, when it comes to the most definitive vision of Superman, even if it's not a modern vision of Superman, it's a 40-year-old conception of the character. Sure. But when it comes to pitch-perfect casting, I don't think you get any better than Christopher Reeve.
Fair enough. And I will say that you are exactly the in the same boat as Zaki Hassan, who obviously you know from various podcasts.
He's a partner of mine on Discovery Debrief. He's a great guy.
Yeah. Oh, he definitely is, and he was on for our Superman the movie review, and he as well said Christopher Reeve and Superman the movie. So you guys are definitely on the same wavelength there. I find it interesting that Jordan, before we get into that, why don't you do as you always do and read our trusty. IMDb description of the movie. Before we get into that, folks, I just want to do a spoiler warning, even though the movie is... How old is the movie now?
38 years old.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you haven't seen this movie, you probably came to the wrong podcast. I'm guessing. But we usually have a fun guessing game, Chris, with the IMDb description. Whether it's one sentence or more. So what's your guess
on the
length of the description?
You know, I actually might have written one a long time ago. Okay, so but I'm going to guess two sentences.
All right, I'll go with the under and say one, just because.
One. All right, Adam's got it this time.
These guys are, man, they're getting lazy over there.
This might have been the one Chris wrote.
Well, in that case, good job. Well, read it, and then we'll see.
Superman agrees to sacrifice his powers to start a relationship with Lois Lane, unaware that three Kryptonian criminals he inadvertently released are conquering Earth. Directed by Richard Lester, or Richard Donner, if you're watching the Richard Donner cut. And let's see. Writing credits, Mario Puzo's story, and then screenplay credits, Mario Puzo, David Newman, and Leslie Newman.
That wasn't your description, was it?
No, it was not. I don't think so. I think I was a little bit more verbose than one.
Yeah, I kind of figured. Just having read some of your stuff and listened to your various podcasts, I figured you'd go more, you know, to quote Justice League's marketing, all in on the description.
Yeah, exactly.
And speaking of Justice League, since you mentioned it, I find that the Superman 2 behind-the-scenes scenario is quite similar to what kind of went on with Justice League similar, but it's almost like history is sort of repeating itself.
To a degree, yeah. I actually recently wrote about that because, you know, you have a significant amount of some of the more vocal elements of the fan base who are saying release the Snyder Cut. Yeah. And I take the position, and I put it in a recent movies.com article that I wrote, a Snyder Cut does not exist because he was forced to leave the production far too early to even really get in the editing bay. I mean, I understand that Zack Snyder probably does some element of editing as he goes along.
Sure.
But I don't think that he had enough time to finish a version of the cut. But really, if there was going to be a Snyder cut, then conceivably the final cut of Justice League that we saw had a lot of footage that was shot by Joss Whedon. And it would have to probably go through a similar sort of reconstructive process as the Richard Donner cut of Superman 2,
right,
where, you know, not only would he have to assemble elements of the footage that he shot that was then left on the cutting room floor, but he would also probably have to fashion new material in order to get to as close to the original conception of the movie as he possibly could.
Sure.
So, you know, it would be a little bit more complicated than what some fans seem to think, where, oh, you have the full Snyder cut and you have this full junkie XL score sitting in a lot somewhere. And no, yeah, it's not that simple. It's just not that simple.
It's not. And the only thing I can say is, I mean, if we're ever going to get a somewhat version of what Snyder intended, even if that eventually becomes a possibility, you might have to wait 20 some odd years like we did with Superman 2. I mean, it's not something
potentially
that you could throw out on Blu-ray next week and say, oh, here you go. And look, I enjoyed Justice League for what we got. It sounds like you did as well, Chris, and I know Jordan did. And I would watch a Zack Snyder cut if they ever gave us one, but I enjoyed the movie that I got, so I'm not in a rush to say, yeah, let me see this other one now. And you know, I appreciated, before I knew about Superman 2, the Richard Donner cut, I appreciated what we got for mm-hmm. the most part. So and then years later when I got to see it, I'm like, okay, that's interesting, but you know, but it's not like I was sitting there, you know, sitting there dying for this other cut. I happen to enjoy what I got.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I mean, this is a movie, Superman 2, that was released certainly before I was born.
Right.
So,
as
you know,
myself and Jordan too.
So you grow up knowing a movie a certain way, especially when you're a young kid. And then obviously when you get older and you become more aware of the intricacies that are involved in filmmaking, and you see, oh wow, there was a whole nearly other movie that was created from this, that's mm-hmm. fascinating.
Yeah.
And then that whole letter writing campaign in 2004, I think, is when it actually started kicking off,
right,
that kicked the entire thing into gear, and then we get to see an almost entirely different movie.
Right.
That's pretty fascinating. It's very unique in cinema history, from what I understand.
Yeah, I don't think that happens all too often, for sure.
No.
But so let's get into the movie a little bit. I think what I find that I thought was kind of cool, especially with Superman 2, and I think the theatrical cut, and I think the Donner cut, if I remember correctly, Jordan and maybe Chris can confirm or deny if I'm right or not, both opened with a sort of montage, basically catching everybody up to where we were.
It was like a previously on, basically.
Yeah,
kind of
thing, mm-hmm. which I thought, it's always, I mean, the only other movie that I've seen it done for in terms of the superhero realm was Spider-Man 2. And then 3 obviously followed suit and did the same thing. But that was the only other time I had seen it. So when I'd seen Superman 2 for the first time and then noted that watching it again, I'm like, okay, that is really cool. And I wish in some cases, like especially with the MCU, because there's so many of them, it would be kind of cool if they kind of did something like that, where it's like, here's where we are, because watching 14 or 15 movies is a little bit, you know, time consuming and taxing in some degree. So
to me, it seemed kind of weird. It felt very uncinematic. I mean, it felt like a TV show, because I mean, TV shows do that all the time. But to me, it felt kind of jarring. With the film.
I just thought, if you're going to give us the crawl with the, not the crawl, because that calls to mind Star Wars. But if you're going to give us the, you know, the credits the way Superman the movie did, it was kind of cool, because they weren't just repeating or regurgitating themselves. I thought that was a cool addition. And it also, I mean, okay, I watched Superman the movie recently, so I didn't need it. But I can imagine, had I not seen anything for 2 years, you know, if I was in the late 70s, early 80s, that something like that would have been very helpful, because I don't think they had the home video and stuff that obviously not that we do now, but back then I think it was sparse. So I think that was very helpful.
Nowadays you could just pull up the movie as you're sitting in the theater waiting for the next one to begin if you wanted to.
Right. Yeah. Hey,
so
and watch it on your phone. Okay, here we are. No, but I like the way this one opened in terms of what I like about sequels and especially this one is the origin stuff is great. As much as I love the Superman origin, with all that out of the way, we can now just jump right in.
That's one of the places that I like this movie. That's one of the things I like more about this movie personally than Superman the movie. Obviously, on our Superman the movie review, I know I have very different opinions on that movie than both of you guys do. I'm not a big fan of that movie, and I complain that the whole opening, both on Krypton and less so, but still a little bit in Smallville too, that I find really drags and it's boring to me. So I find that is beneficial to this movie, that we just jump right in to Metropolis and we're right there. So I that's one thing I prefer about the sequel to Superman the movie.
Sorry about that. Go ahead, Chris.
Well, one thing about that though is the benefit of a sequel, right? I mean, the detriment of every single first outing or origin story to varying degrees is that it has to get the expository information out of the way. It has to show where all of the pieces are going to fit in for a true proper send off. And I mean, that's one of the benefits of a second movie in general. I mean, probably the most egregious example of a first to second movie is Star Trek, because Star Trek, the motion picture, is notoriously slow. Right. And it reintroduces the characters conceivably if you've never even seen them before from a TV show, or it's reintroducing them if you were familiar with it. But the movie itself was slow. And then what happened in the second one? I mean, you know everybody, and it just drops you into an action-adventure powerhouse that is notoriously recognized as the best movie that series has produced. And I think that's relatively similar in comparison to even like Batman Begins in The Dark Knight. I mean, you spend the first half of Batman Begins just learning who Bruce Wayne is before it even puts him in the suit.
Right.
And then in The Dark Knight, you know who everybody is and you just drop straight away. And Superman follows the same sort of formula.
Right.
I was going to bring that example up too, because I was going to rebut by saying that I don't think it's inherently detrimental to a movie to have that set up, because I'll bring up the example of Batman Begins. You can do it really well. Batman Begins, I'm completely entertained and completely into the beginning of that movie the entire time before Bruce even suits up for the first time.
Sure.
And so I'm just saying, I'm sure you guys disagree, but for me, Superman the movie, I don't like the stuff before he suits up as Superman. So,
well, detriment was not the best word. I mean, it's a shortcoming of every origin story, and it's explored in various ways. It could be more effective and less effective.
And to be fair, Batman Begins had the advantage of the fact that Batman 89 never actually showed us the lead up to him becoming Batman. So getting this from movie audiences, not necessarily for guys like us that read comic books, that was something fresh. And The way Nolan did it with, you know, the flashbacks and how he incorporated all that, things a little bit.
And just if I'm going to, of course, I have to defend Superman the movie a little bit, because it goes back to one of the most fundamental differences between the characters of Superman and Batman. And that is that, by and large, Batman is defined by one singular event. And Superman, by a complete contrast, is defined by his life's experiences up until the moment that he actually does become Superman. And that is an inherently slower burn. You know, you show a wide variety of things that all lead into what will help him define his heroic identity. Whereas with Batman, he has one singular catalyzing moment that pushes him in the direction of becoming the hero that we know. And with Superman, it's totally different.
That's a great distinction to make, and I agree with you in that sense. But not to get back into Superman the movie again, because we did just do an episode, but just to explain where I'm coming from on that. Superman the movie, it's not the fact that it's a slow burn that bugs me. Of course, I'm a huge Smallville fan, and that gave us a slow burn.
That's a pretty slow burn.
Yeah, that was 10 seasons, but I love pretty much every second of Smallville, and so that was an extremely slow burn. It's just I'm not a fan of the way in which Superman the movie showed us that journey. So I guess I guess that's what I'll say.
That's a different, that's a totally
different nobody's perfect
aspect of it. me and Jordan have differing opinions on Superman the movie, among other things. But with Superman 2, with the theatrical cut, because that's the one I watched in preparation for today, it started back on, before it went through the montage that I talked about, it started back on Krypton, and I just want to make sure, was this in the Donner cut as well, where the there's that guy in that outfit, that suit, whatever it is, and I don't know, he's some kind of guard, and then you have Non and Zod and Ursa are there, and Non snaps his neck. Was that in the Donner cut as well?
I think the thing that jumps out at me is the most stark difference between the opening segments of both versions of the movie is the absence of Jor-El in the theatrical cut.
Right, yeah.
Obviously Jor-El was absent in the entire theatrical cut, but it really does seem kind of awkward when you watch the theatrical version of the movie and, you know, Jor-El, who was obviously the most pivotal character in the opening segment of Superman the movie, is just gone.
Yeah.
And it just has to focus on the fact that, well, someone jailed the Kryptonian criminals, but you don't really see who it was. They kind of go off.
They kind of redid that whole segment, but just with, the disembodied voices.
Yeah.
And the floating heads, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But then we get to, so we do the, you know, it has the catch-up montage during the credits. And then what I think separates two from one for me a lot is the portrayal of Lois Lane. I actually like Margot Kidder as Lois Lane in the second one, where I wasn't as fond of her in the first one, because we get the more hard-hitting investigative reporter that gets herself into trouble for the sake of a story, and the whole Paris sequence, right, with the terrorists and the bombers.
That's not in the Donner cut,
right?
I
know it's different, but for me, seeing that aspect of Lois Lane, just the fact that here's more of the Lois Lane I expect, really separates this movie. This may be sacrilege to some people, but I actually like two a little bit better than one. And part of it is Lois Lane's portrayal. So there was that, and then what I liked about the whole sequence was that, and I know the Donner cut is different. You guys can talk about that in a second. But what I liked about the whole Paris and the Eiffel Tower thing was that they gave you a in-story reason and a consequence of how the other three Kryptonians got out of their captivity. It was the bomb from the elevator thing that Superman threw into space. That the reverberations from that cracked the Phantom Zone. And I know in the Donner cut it was different. So, but before speaking, while speaking to that, what do you guys think of, like, talk about that, and then give me your thoughts on Lois Lane. Do you find her more to be more traditional in the sense of the go-getter, the investigative reporter in this one than she was in the first? Chris, go first.
Oh, okay. Well, in regards to the rocket, I think that the Donner cut makes more sense just because it's showing the rocket from the first movie that actually, you know, served. And so in a way, it's a little bit more poetic. I mean, obviously, in the second movie, it's still, or in the theatrical version of the second movie, it's still technically Superman's fault. But the connective tissue between one and two that was restored in the Donner cut, I tend to prefer. But I mean, the Paris scene is entertaining. I mean, I remember, weirdly enough, I remember watching this movie, I think before I had graduated high school, so I was still living at home, and my mom came in, and she watched it with me for a few minutes. And when Superman catches the elevator, and he says, "I believe this is your floor," for some reason that was like weirdly offensive to her, like, "Oh, that's so goofy," and, I think in a way that that's kind of a microcosm of the way that Richard Lester approached the material. And you certainly got to see that he had a more whimsical take by the time Superman 3 came out.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But I mean, I think that the Paris scene that Lester shot, it certainly has value. But if I had to choose, then I would choose the Donner cut.
Well, right, as the fact that it makes sense more with the, you know, like you said, the connective tissue.
Right.
Yeah. I agree. I just like that scene. I like that scene more for not necessarily because it gave you a plausible explanation in that version of how the three got out. I just prefer to me. The selling point of that scene was the portrayal of Lois Lane. Like,
yeah, sure. And I mean, Margot Kidder obviously having a little bit more time to live in the role a little bit. And, you know, in the Paris scene, since they were shooting one and two, or since Donner was shooting one and two concurrently, she had the same amount of time to be Lois Lane. But by the time they were shooting the Paris scene, she had lived with the character a little bit more.
Sure, yeah, right.
I think that's evident in the Paris scene itself.
That was probably a reshoot for sure. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that the interesting thing that I found the whole scene, like once we get, you know, I'm jumping around a little bit, but I why not? It's we often do that on this show. But one of the things that I found entertaining and actually quite not frightening in the sense that it scared me, but I could put myself in the shoes of the characters. When the three Kryptonians do like land on the moon, and they just like go to town on that on those astronauts and the space station. I'm like, okay, it's funny to me because I'm watching something that's, you know, clearly in the vein of the 80s, and, you know, obviously the special effects are different and whatnot. But I can understand if I put myself in the shoes of the participants. I can see why these three would be menacing and this would be a scary proposition. So I think, you know, it did a good job with walking that fine line most of the time of you know, Lester's more whimsical thing with that friendly nature of the three Kryptonians and just like the awe of, oh my God, these are these, imagine Superman, but not as good as Superman, like a bad.
Oh yeah.
And so I thought there was a nice balance there, especially with the three Kryptonians. And was that similar in the cut? Like, let's do a compare and contrast. Was that the same in the Donner cut? Like their intro sort of thing?
I believe so. Yeah, I mean, it's largely unaltered. I mean, for some reason the context that's given in the Donner cut seems a little harder edge, where you are able to more accurately see just how frightening that kind of moment is.
Right.
And I mean, even though shot for shot there, it's, I don't know if it's completely identical, but it's relatively identical.
It's really close. Yeah.
I mean, just the idea of Ursa going up and ripping the patch off. And I mean, yeah, if you put yourself isn't there that shot where the astronaut is trying kind of pathetically to hop away from her?
Yeah, 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 there is. Yeah.
And there's just no getting away from it. Right. And if you put yourself in that moment, that's probably not the most easy thing to take.
And it was cool because the part about it that I found humorous was when he's like, we have a problem here, and the guy's like, what's the situation? He's like, there's a girl, there's a flying. it's like it reminded me of the scene, not obviously not the same context, but when the cop describes Batman driving on the rooftops in Batman Begins, and he's like, you got a tank, a black tank, and it's just that kind of you know, it's shocking, but it's also for the audience, it's humorous in the same respect.
Yeah, sure.
I thought the balance, even though Lester at times later in the movie, and we'll get to it, I think he went overboard. In those scenes, I thought he was it was on point. Jordan, what was your take on what I said about Lois and also the introduction of the whole space intro of the three Kryptonians? What's your take on that?
Yeah, well, I don't think I see as much of a difference in Margot Kidder's Lois between the two films as you do. I don't think I dislike her as much as you do in the first one, and I don't think I like her as much as you do in this one. I'm just kind of indifferent to her in both movies, to be honest, and in the whole quadrilogy, actually. In terms of the way the that Zod and Ursa and Nan escape, I personally the way it is in the Donner cut, I'm not opposed to it just in that. But then what really bothers me is later when we see Jor-El explain. He's like, yes, they are trapped forever in the Phantom Zone, unless of course there's a nuclear explosion next to them, which will allow them to escape. And I'm like, wow, isn't that convenient? That's exactly what happened in just during this film. I'm like, I thought that was absurd. and then in terms of the introduction, I think that this is one of those places where I can't put myself in 1980. The effects are so bad in that moon scene to me that I can see what they were going for and how it could have been cool, but it just comes off as really cheesy to me.
Yeah, Chris, just so you know, Jordan doesn't have the... We've discovered, Zaki and I have discovered that Jordan doesn't have the capability to place himself in the time period that he's watching the movie. Like, he can't look at it and not see, like, he's looking at it from the lens of modern effects.
Oh, geez. Well, don't watch Flash Gordon or don't watch Alien or Aliens.
He can't divorce himself from that, you know, the time periods. He can't.
Don't watch the serials then. My God, watch the 40s and 50s serials.
But and the other thing here, I'll go further with my Lois Lane banter because I think it's important. And again, this is another difference between the two movies. When she finds out about Superman, in the theatrical cut, she is, they're in Niagara Falls, and there's that dumb kid that decides, I'm going to go over the rail. Superman saves him. At that moment, she kind of puts together that, wait a minute, every time Superman shows up, Clark's not around. And so then she gets the smart idea of, okay, to test my theory, I'm going to call him on it, and then throw myself over a rail that's not as steep as what the kid did, and he'll save me, right? And then that'll reveal that he's super. That'll prove my point. I like the fact that they actually show Lois really putting the pieces together and kind of coming up with a scenario of how am I going to out him as super? How am I going to get him to admit? I like that whole exchange, all those scenes, and also. Even Superman and Clark's reaction and how he temporarily preserved the secret by using his discreetly his X-ray vision to sort of provide her with a branch to grab onto and then rescue her in a more naturalistic fumbling Clark Kent kind of way to dispel any of her notions, at least temporarily. I thought all that worked really, really well. And again, I thought Margot Kidder was quite good in those scenes. And I know in the Donner cut, it's different. So, Chris, if you would mind, speak to my thoughts on the theatrical version of that, and then also give us a take on what you saw from the Donner cut.
Well, this is, I think, something that shows a clear advantage to the theatrical cut, because the clear benefit is that they were able to shoot a scene.
Right.
there's no real way around it. I mean, it's nice to see in the Donner cut that he wanted to try and preserve what the original intent was going to be, but he didn't shoot a scene. So he was off the production by the time they were able to get around to that.
Sure.
From a historical standpoint, it's cool to see that screen test in the full context of what the movie was supposed to, or in this case, two screen tests that he kind of put together with some editing trickery. But I think that the execution of the theatrical cut does speak to his attempt to delineate his two personalities in a way that's a little bit stronger than the original version of the theatrical cut. So, I mean, it's a funny game of sort of give and take, you know? I mean, there are some aspects of Richard Lester's philosophy towards Superman that really kind of make me go, what the hell was he thinking? But then there are others where you could see that if you wanted to try and analyze it from the perspective of someone who does know Superman and Clark Kent and the lengths that he goes to try and separate those two personalities. I mean, it's not quite like, I don't know, having Matrix pose as Clark Kent coming out from the rubble at the end of the Return of Superman story, yeah. But it is kind of fun to see that he is trying to dissuade her from that conclusion as much as he possibly can. So I think the theatrical cut is a little bit stronger in that regard, but I do like seeing the screen tests.
And in the Donner cut, did they not have a scene? Because I remember it now. If I'm making something up, it could be the case because my mind wanders often. But was she not drawing glasses and a fedora on the?
She did. Yeah, that was an originally shot scene in the actual Daily Planet set, because that's another thing that's not entirely clear when you watch the theatrical version, is that the actual Daily Planet office sets are identical to the original movie in the Donner cut, but they are different. They're subtly different in the theatrical cut. Right. And yeah, that's one of the things that they shot,
and
was
then
her
she
actually
threw herself out a window.
Out a window. Yeah, right. Yes. Okay. And one of the coolest things about that is you see him use his super speed, and really the only time that you actually see, like on foot,
yeah,
to zoom out and the papers fly up in the office and he goes right. out and he just kind of slows her fall from the floor before he goes back up and says, Lois, what have you done? Yeah, and yeah.
I like both of those. You're right about the screen test. I mean, from a historical point, I'm like, oh, that's cool. But from watching it as part of a movie, it's like, oh boy. But I like the lead up to all that, in the ways that she tries to get him to admit. I thought in both I appreciated the way they were done. Jordan, I'm assuming that you enjoyed the effects in the screen test because there were none, correct? Is that?
Well, it's really funny because watching the Donner cut, and they have a message at the beginning of the movie saying that there's places where they used a screen test because they didn't have the actual footage. And so I was looking out for it, right? And so when I got to that scene,
there's no looking out. You could play, even if they didn't have that, it's plain as day. It's like,
well, that's what I was about to say. I was looking out for it, and when that scene came up, I noticed that was where it was, and I was like, oh, this is where they use the screen test. But it wasn't as egregious as I thought it was going to be. Like, I'm genuinely not sure if I hadn't been looking out for it, if I would have noticed that it was a screen test.
Well, there's the dead giveaway, because they do use later on in the second screen test that they use, because they basically combined a very early one before Christopher Reeve had even done any bodybuilding work, and he had a completely different pair of glasses, and a later one that actually does resemble the glasses that he does have in the final
skinnier,
movie.
Correct.
Oh, yeah. He was really skinny. It was before David Prowse was able to get a lot of work done with him. Because that was, I mean, that's one of the things that endeared Richard Donner to Christopher Reeve. When their first meeting, he wore a sweater that was like three times too big to try and make himself look bigger. But it just emphasized how skinny he was. He's just a Juilliard trained, very young actor.
Right.
And then it was when David Prowse got to work with him, Darth Vader himself, who helped build up Superman.
By the way, I have to mention this. That's another shout out for you, unintentionally this time, Rick Shue, because we know how much you love Star Wars and mentioning Star Wars on every single Batman on Film podcast when you can. So there it is. We did that one for you.
That's true. Oh, man.
Oh, boy.
He and my buddy Paul are Star Wars brothers. Yeah. But no, I mean, it does go to the huge difference in the screen test footage and the final footage when you actually do see, whoa, okay, first of all, those glasses are really different and his neck is pencil thin. And then, you know, it just kind of makes it stick out a little bit. But I can see, Jordan, it emphasizes the skill of the editing in the Donner cut, because by trying to minimize as much as possible the fact that they used screen test footage, the editing is very seamless and they do a very good job of actually putting it in the movie. So I can totally understand that perspective.
Now, since we're in this, in this portion of the film, I want to stick with it before moving to Lex Luthor and going back to the other Kryptonians. But So then you have the part at the hotel, and where he, you know, Lois is sort of trying to, you know, dry herself off and get warm, and then Clark trips over that pink bear rug that's in the middle of the floor. And
real polyester.
Yeah. You can tell this was the 80s by the decoration of that set, I'll tell you. So he trips over the bear and the bear rug, and the glasses fall into the fire. He grabs it right away and puts them back on before Lois can see. But obviously, she knows that she saw him put his hand in the fire. She examines it. He's fine. And then, oh, you are Superman. I love the part where he's, you know, he physically gets upset at him, I guess, himself. And then as you see him, once he admits it and he's walking away from her, and again, he's slightly hunched over in Clark Kent mode. And then when he straightens up, it is really striking how, it's funny to say, but how different that slouch can make you kind of buy the whole glasses.
Oh, yeah.
Otherwise, in a modern context, like if they tried to do that nowadays in a Superman movie, I think just the glasses by themselves, you'd have to just say, I can't. Like, where everybody's got a cell phone walking across that, how nobody can look up on the TV and see a news report of Superman in a freeze frame on a picture and then look over at Clark and say, no, they look nothing alike. But
did you hear about Henry Cavill one day?
Yeah, I was just going to say.
I get it, but it's in that context, how many New Yorkers are actively like, yeah, Henry Cavill is going to show up right here. Like, they're not, you know what I'm saying? I get what he was trying to pull off. I totally get it, and I'm glad that it worked. And I'm not making fun of the glasses disguise, because I love Superman. And look, I accept that, I follow a character that can fly and shoot heat vision out of his eyes and freeze things with his breath. And so I just...
And turn the world around to turn nighttime.
Let's not go there until we have to, please. The will of God and everything holy. It's,
well, but what you're saying, though, is to me one of the things that makes Christopher Reeve's vision of Superman so definitive, right. Is the fact that he was able to craft two very distinct personalities through this single performer.
Yeah.
And I mean, this, what you mention is directly descended from the scene in the first movie in Lois's apartment. And it shows his skill as an actor.
Yeah.
It shows his skill to create Clark Kent and to create Superman and to make them very different, to lend to the further plausibility of that disguise. Because Clark Kent and Superman in these movies are two very different people. And Christopher Reeve's dedication to actually pull that off is what sells it. And and it sells it very effectively.
And it was even, like, I thought the first time, because I even mentioned that scene in our Superman the movie review, I thought that was striking then. I think it just, like, it got even more striking the second time he did that, you know, in the sequel. I'm like, oh, wow, it's even more pronounced.
Oh, sure, well, because his intent was actually to show her.
Yeah.
Whereas before, you know, he changed his mind at the last second. But with this, he's trying to show her, look, it's me.
So
I am this guy.
Yeah. So I just love that aspect of it. And then they go to the fortress, and here's where I start having a little bit of problem with this whole dynamic, because I'm totally down with him. I totally 100% buy that he's head over heels for every aspect of Lois Lane as a person. I totally get that from Clark Kent and Superman and Chris Reeve and all that. And so that he's willing to give up his powers, I'm okay with that. And even to the point where I like the fact that this film took a stance on that issue, whereas if he's going to be with a human woman, he has to choose to live as a human. Because certain portrayals of Superman, like, they each have their own stance, so that, for instance, Lois and Clark, he was able to be with her while being Superman. Smallville, I assumed, just from what I saw, that as long as he controlled himself, the same thing applies. Correct? This one mm-hmm. took a very staunch stance on it and said, no, if you're going to, you know, go there, then you got to become a human being, you know, full stop. It kind of bugs me, where especially because when she's like, so this is your home. He's like, oh, no, I live three blocks from you. This is just, you know, my... But the fact... And I'm cool with all that. But the thing that really started bothering me about this scene was after he gives up his powers, there's conveniently a bed with these silky, satiny sheets just there. But he never... But that's not his home. But the bed is there. And my problem is this film takes place shortly thereafter Superman 1, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Presumably not much time at all has passed. Maybe a right. week, 2 weeks, give or take.
If that.
The fact that she just found out, they officially now have just professed their love to each other. There just so happens to be a bed there. And now it's like, all right, let's go. And it's I'm like, really?
Is it possible he flew?
This is
he
their
flew,
first official he... date? And we're going here already?
Just speaking on the bed part, isn't it possible that he's so quick, couldn't he have flown and got the bed and then brought it back?
I guess, but still...
Hey, if I had a Fortress of Solitude, there are some nights I might want to crash there. You know?
Sure, I get it. It was just... It just felt a little bit... I don't know what the right word is, but it was like... It was more the fact that, okay, literally this is your first real date where you're each aware of who each other is fully, to the fullest degree. And now it's you're just going to go there, right? Like, right off the bat. Like, there's no...
Maybe he was just a little too excited to know, hey, there's nothing I can do to hurt her now.
Yeah,
so, I don't know.
It freaks me out a little bit. I got to say, I'm not trying to be a prude or anything like that. Because, hey, well, whatever. But it just... I don't know. I felt that was a little bit... I was like, all right, we're there already. Okay. This is kind of weird.
They're soulmates. I mean, they're soulmates.
But then again, to be fair, Superman had a bath with Lois Lane in BVS 18 months after BVS. But it, to me, while I'm like, okay, really, you're going in the bath with your fully clothed? Come on, Superman, you should have...
Well, you know,
be more
part
common
of
sense than that.
Part of it too. I wonder if, and I this is just total speculation on my part. I have idea if this is the case.
Before you go into that, Chris, am I the only one that is weirded out by this? Is everybody else, both of you, are totally cool with that?
I didn't really. It didn't really bother me at the time, I suppose, just because...
It doesn't take up points of the movie or anything. It's just...
No, I understand. But, I mean, maybe if they had just met, it would be one thing. And maybe if they had firmly established over the course of 1.5 movies that they were pretty well devoted to each other, maybe it would. But, I mean, the thing that I was just going to say, though, and, of course, again, I have to qualify this. I have no idea if this is the case. But the same year that the Donner Cut came out, you know, they firmly established that in Superman Returns, Lois was going to have a son.
Oh, right, yeah.
And, you know, obviously there is a little bit of connective tissue between at least definitely the first one, parts of the second one, and Superman Returns.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm sure that they wanted... I'm sure that when Superman Returns was being made, it was made with the intention of doing a sequel at some point.
Definitely. Yeah.
So, I mean, and of course, just speculation. I have no idea if that actually went into it when they were reconstructing what the Donner Cut was going to look like. But it seems at least a little plausible that they were trying to find a way, continuity wise, to potentially clear the way for... For Jason White. Yeah.
So I totally get it. And there's probably some truth to that for sure. But now let's talk about, and the reason I brought that up aside from getting to that, was that here's where there's a lot of, in the theatrical cut, he's talking to his mother, which I thought was a nice touch because even though I enjoy seeing Marlon Brando again in the Donner Cut, I like the idea that the first one kind of focused on on the relationship with his relationship with Jor-El, and here we're getting a little bit more exploration with Lara, because Lara to me is a criminally underused character in any portion of Superman's origin. Usually mm-hmm. she just stands there and hands Jor-El the baby. It's like, here, yeah. now I'm gonna cry, and then off he goes. So anytime we get to spend with Lara, I'm kind of fond of that. But in the theatrical cut, it was in the Donner cut, it was all Jor-El, correct?
Yes.
That did the same, and the speech was essentially, the same idea behind it was that if you're gonna be with her, you have to.
Yeah.
And I think Jor-El got a bit more forceful, if I remember correctly. He was kind of.
He did. He seemed a little more out and out angry at the idea that he's going to throw away his duty to humanity in order to be with a single human being. Yeah.
Whereas the mother was like, you love her. I get it. You know, and the mother was more typical, you know, moms are.
Right.
So yeah, I think that's a striking difference. Jordan, what was your take? I mean, I know that you are fixated on Lana and Clark from Smallville, but put that aside for a second.
I only have an attachment to that relationship in on Smallville.
I hear about it every week, but put that aside for a second. and what did you think of this whole? Do you like what you saw when you saw the Donner cut, or do you prefer it being Jor-El? Like, what's your and do you have a problem with him and her and Superman? Going there right away, or
I'm indifferent to most of it, quite honestly. I don't have a problem with them going there right away. One thing I didn't want to bring up though is just going back to our Superman the movie discussion, Adam. You said it was preposterous that Clark would have told Lois his identity, or that it would have been revealed.
No, in that first meeting, for sure.
Right. Well, what I'm saying is that they did it the very next movie. So,
right, but they knew each other longer. I mean, it wasn't much longer, but they had more time with each other. Whereas, you know.
Okay. Right. Oh, I see what you're saying. Because I thought what your argument was that because it would have been because of the time because they like
Zachy said that about revealing that, whereas Man of Steel had Lois in on it. From the beginning, and then Smallville later on, you know, by the time before he goes full-fledged Superman, Lois knew.
And I propose that they should have done something like that in Superman the movie, because when you brought up the fact that Lois not knowing Clark's identity made her look stupid in that movie, I think I brought up the fact that...
In the first movie, my problem was more her just, I don't know, the fact that she couldn't spell worth a lick. And you know,
that's what
bothered me. But Zachy brought up the point about how Richard Donner, at that point when they were doing the first movie, would have not done something unheard of in the comic books of having Clark reveal, like willingly tell Lois that Clark and Superman were one and the same.
Even that she would figure it out, that he wouldn't tell her willingly, but that she would figure it out as a reporter
I'm
in Man of Steel.
I'm happy that she figured it out. Makes her look like the smart reporter that I know Lois Lane to be.
Right. Me too. But I can't remember whether it was you or Zachy that brought up that they wouldn't do that because there was no precedent for that in the comics, and that Donner wouldn't even have thought of that at the time. So I'm curious, given that in the sequel that's exactly what happens – I'm just curious what your stance on that is. I can't remember whether it was you. If it wasn't you that said that.
No, it was Zachy that brought that idea up.
Okay. It was Zachy.
But
okay.
I'm okay with her finding out and then him admitting it. In the second movie, for sure, but like I said, because they've spent more time with each other as opposed to...
Okay, so that's the difference.
Had
okay.
he told her right then and there, you know, after the flight, essentially, the first flight.
Or had she figured out, though, if she had figured it out.
Yeah, but Lois in one was in no position to figure anything out. She couldn't even spell rapist. So how could she figure out Superman and Clark were the same? You know, so... So I have no problem with it. But do you have a preference, Jordan, before... I was going to say... Of Jor-El being the voice of the parental voice in this situation, or Lara, do you
prefer? I'm cool either way.
Okay, that was what I was getting at. One of the things that I enjoyed about this movie more than I did the first movie was Lex Luthor, simply because there was now, Chris, you probably haven't listened to our Superman the movie discussion, so I'll give you a little bit of background. I can't stand the fact that Lex Luthor surrounds himself with you know, a moron in Otis, and then somebody who is neither here nor there with
Miss Teschmacher.
Yeah, and so I appreciated the fact that it is very minimal, their inclusion in at least the theatrical cut. And I appreciated Lex a lot more because he was nefarious enough smart enough actually to be able to track Superman and then find the fortress, and also in his means of getting out of incarceration. I thought that showed quite a bit of cunning and intelligence from Lex, and as well to have the wherewithal to use. You know, to use the emergence of these three Kryptonians to his advantage. I thought that was very much more in keeping with a Lex that I'm familiar with and comfortable with than what we got the first time around. So I much preferred Lex Luthor in two than I did in one. Now, maybe it's just me, but there are certain scenes, and I may have read that this was the case, but there were certain scenes when they weren't close up where Lex Luthor did not sound like Gene Hackman.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so it wasn't just my ears.
No, because Gene Hackman refused to come back after Richard Donner was fired.
Okay.
So they had to hire a sound-alike to actually fill in some of the gaps between the footage that they shot afterward.
I don't know how much that sound-alike sounded like him.
Yeah, no, I mean, you could notice. I mean, it was just sort of like a close enough type of thing where... It most certainly was not Gene Hackman.
So it was just me. It wasn't just me. And again, I like the fact that to me, what's your take on Lex, Chris, in terms of?
Well, you know, in regards to surrounding himself with stupid people, there's something about that seems truthful, at least to this particular vision of Lex. I mean, overall, I am not a fan of Gene Hackman's Lex Luthor because Lex Luthor to me is one of the single most fascinating villains in comics, precisely because of the fact that he sees himself as virtuous as opposed to conniving. You know, like this version of Lex Luthor in these movies takes pride in the fact that he is, you know, the greatest criminal mind of our time. Where
he says, Luthor, how many times does he say it?
Oh yeah. Dozens and dozens of times.
It's on repeat.
If you weren't clear about it, that's what he thinks of himself. Whereas the Lex Luthor that I gravitate towards is the guy who thinks he's saving humanity from the terrifying alien that could burn us all down. Right. You know, that's to me one of the most defining traits of Lex Luthor. But from the perspective of the Luthor in this movie, you know, I know people in real life who are very intelligent, but they have they're friends with very stupid people, so that they always say that they're the smartest person in the room. Oh. You know, I prefer to be friends with people who are smarter than me because I'm always learning something. But I know that there are people out there who prefer to surround themselves with stupidity so that they can all have sort of intellectual superiority. And that's where I think this version of Luther comes from. Like, it's a very understandable perspective from a guy who also takes pride in the fact that he's a criminal.
Right.
But if I have to say, you know, which version compared to, you know, the theatrical and the Donner cut that I prefer, mm-hmm. it's going to be the Donner cut. Not the least of which because you have a consistent performance from a single actor. And, you know, as much as I don't necessarily like the Gene Hackman conception of Lex Luthor, I can appreciate the dedication that Hackman brings to it because he's not phoning it in. You know, sure, I mean, sure. he's creating a villain that, yes, would probably have a bigger place on the 60s Batman show. But I can appreciate what Hackman himself brings to it overall.
Right. And,
so,
but would you agree with my statement that it, like, the fact that he was playing the Kryptonians, you know, like the three Kryptonians, and then when Superman got involved, off each other for his own needs, is more keeping with the Lex Luthor that you and I seem to be in tune with.
Yeah, I mean, it hints at that that five steps ahead Luthor that we know. I mean,
that
obviously
that's he's trying to peek out of this movie somewhere, but it wasn't
well, and, and, you know, jumping around a little bit more, but at the end, you know, when he tries to say, did you see the way they fell into our trap? I mean, yeah, that's kind of like the last ditch desperate attempt to connive in that way. Yeah. But yeah, no, I agree with you.
Now Jordan, you liked Tweedledee and Tweedledum in the last movie. So what was your take on the fact that they weren't there as much, and then Lex in this, you know, in two?
Hashtag not enough Otis.
Oh God.
This is the one place when it comes to the Christopher Reeve movies where I'm much more positive on them than you are, Adam. I said it on our Superman the movie review how much I love Otis.
But I don't understand how a guy that loves Michael Rosenbaum's iteration is so gung-ho about Otis and Miss Deathsmark. I don't get it.
Okay, first of all, I will say Otis was in the season 11 comics for Smallville. And he was very similar.
I'm trying to forget these callbacks, man. You keep bringing them up.
he was portrayed very similarly to how he is in the Christopher Reeve movie. So that's one thing I will say. I've said it before. Michael Rosenbaum is far and away my favorite Lex Luthor, and I wish that Gene Hackman had given a performance that was cold and calculating like Michael Rosenbaum. That being said, for what it is, I find Gene Hackman very funny in the role. However, in this movie, this is my least favorite portrayal of Lex in the three movies that he was in, and here's the reason. I do like that we see in this movie how he's very manipulative with the Kryptonians. I think that's awesome, but I can't quite take it seriously because of Hackman's performance, which goes back, he was playing it for laughs, and so it takes away from that. But here's where Superman 1 and Superman 4 get a bonus for me when it comes to Hackman's Luthor, and it's because in Superman 1 he had Otis with him the whole time, and they played off each other, and it was just hilarious. I talked about that on Superman the movie review, how much they cracked me up. Superman 4 he had John Cryer, Lenny, to play off of, and I love that too. In this movie, he didn't have somebody like that. He had the Kryptonians, which I'll get into that. I really do not care for Zod or
Ursa. Yeah, we'll get there next. But yeah,
we'll get into that, right? But they're not played. I find them laughable, but they're not played for laughs, so it's not. It doesn't have the same comedic effect him playing off of them. For most of this movie. My favorite scene in this entire movie, because it relates to this, is the prison scene with Otis.
Sure.
That's my favorite scene in this entire movie, is Otis, and he's like talking about the guy who like wets his bed, and then he pulls open the curtain and the guy's standing right there. I love that. And like him and Lex trying to escape, and Lex is like, did you say psh? And he's like, no, but I wish I had before we left, Mr. Luthor. And he's like,
it's funny. I just don't get me wrong.
It's
I
so
laugh.
Funny.
It just,
and he like he sees Miss Tessmacher. Hi, Miss Tessmacher. And Lex tells him to shut up.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, I love all of that. I only like that is one thing I wish about this movie. I wish Otis had made it on that ladder so we got to see him for the rest of this movie. Because I was
thankful when he didn't.
You just said it was funny.
It was funny. Doesn't mean I wanted around every scene Luther's in.
I wanted Otis. I wanted more of Otis in this movie. Is what I'll say.
Of course you did, because you and I often we agree on some things and then we're totally divergent on others, which is.
I think, and I brought this up on our Superman the movie review because I have trouble viewing these movies as how am I trying to say this? I can't. I have trouble taking these movies seriously as a whole, personally. And so for me, whereas I think for a lot of people who love these movies, and I understand this, Otis is like this comedic. It takes away from the seriousness of the movie for me because I'm not viewing the whole in the same way as a lot of people do. Otis is like this crazy over the top hilarious character that just every time he's on screen he elevates the movie because he just cracks me up so much and I find him so entertaining. He's my favorite part of I said it on a Superman the movie review. He's my favorite part of this movie, and frankly, even in the one scene he was in this movie, two scenes I guess you could consider it, he's my favorite part of this movie as well.
All right, fair enough. I can't argue with your reasoning. But we mentioned them before their first appearance, the three Kryptonians. Now let's delve into that a little bit. I like the three Kryptonians. When they arrive in Houston, or Planet Houston, as they come to adopt the name, I thought the exploration, like the fact that that Ursa was kind of, you know, surprised by her abilities, and Zod was like, of course we have these powers. It seems to me that Zod would have had knowledge of, at least this is the way I thought of it, would have had knowledge of the fact that a yellow sun would have given them these extra abilities. Just in the way he spoke, when Ursa expressed, you know, excitement or about having these abilities, and then to converse that with Nod, like when you see General Zod and Ursa using their heat vision, and Nod the whole friggin' movie is trying to get it to work, and he's so excited when it does. That I found funny, that I enjoyed, and it was kind of cool to see, like, there's a scene where Zod is in the water, and then he's sort of quote unquote walking on water, and the guy that's there is like looking in like dismay, just he can't believe what he's seeing. There's the cool scene where Ursa picks up the snake and it bites her, and then, you know, she burns it to a crisp. I'm sure that offended PETA and a lot of other people, but it's there. When they get to, you know, I want to call it the destruction of Houston. I don't know what to call that scene, the destruction in Houston. That whole scene I thought was really well done. And then when you see, I mean, you can tell that what's his name, Terrence Stamp. There are times when he takes it, you know, a little bit over the top in certain areas, but when he's
free,
when he's playing it more on the you know, the straight and narrow, you know, the serious angle, he really is a frightening and demanding and what's the word, foreboding character, you know, like he really does that well when he goes in that direction. I think one of the scenes is where he's giving that address to the television, or when he's talking to the general. So I think, and I even when he does take it overboard, you know, with the kneel before Zod, I like it. I know Jordan probably doesn't, but I enjoy it. And then, like, the scene with the president where he's like, you know, who's the leader? And then the guy that's covering for the president, you know, steps forward, and then he kneels and he goes, you're not the president. He goes, a leader of so many men would not kneel so willingly. I like those kind of aspects. When he goes, like I said, that serious route, he really is a formidable character and quite threatening. So I really like, but I thought on the whole, if I had to peg it, I think Ursa is the scariest one of the bunch. She's mm-hmm. the most threatening in the bunch. What's your take on the three Kryptonians, Chris?
Overall, I mean, you have to start somewhere, basically. And although I'm not a huge fan, particularly of the way that Nan is conceived, I do think that they're effective because, I mean, it's the first time in a live action outing, certainly, that Superman is confronted with an equal and actually more powerful enemy for him to fight. And, you know, that's something that Superman cinema has struggled with before the modern era, is that, you know, Superman 2 was really only, I mean, I guess you could technically say the quest for peace against Nuclear Man, that he fought an equal and opposite force of nature, but he dispatched Nuclear Man with relative ease, all things considered.
Or himself in Superman 3, I guess you could technically say.
Yeah, technically, although, I mean, did that really happen?
Yeah, that was more of an internal struggle.
I mean, that's the thing, is like, if you're confronted with fighting a vision of yourself potentially mentally, then that might be something something else entirely. But
side note, that was one of my favorite scenes in all four films.
Absolutely. Yeah, no argument here. But, I mean, as far as the villains themselves are concerned, I mean, this was certainly my first exposure to General Zod. And I didn't really have too strong of an idea of how he would appear in the source material until I started to absorb the source material more seriously when I was probably a young teenager, is when I really started to hit the books really hard. No, I mean, watching it now, there's a degree of ham that was more permissible back then, right? And Terrence Stamp, he is a more serious conception of what a Superman villain can look like, especially when compared to Lex Luthor. Right. But I think that he deserves a lot of credit for creating a character in his mind that... really, Terrence Stamp defined the overriding self-interest that we know Zod to have in any medium. And that also kind of extends to the way that Jaxxar was portrayed in Superman the Animated Series, who was, for all intents and purposes, the version of Zod that that show would get. But even in the comics, you know, I mean, of course, Richard Donner himself had a direct... and in one of the most visible visions of Zod that we've had in the comics over the last decade and a half or so. But, I mean, even if you read Suicide Squad now, it's hard not to read Zod with Terrence Stamp's voice.
It really is. And especially when they have the panels where he's doing the whole kneel before Zod. I can't help but just go into that over-the-top, you know, version of it as I'm reading.
Yeah.
It's just, I can't help it, and it's
yeah, and so I think that's an instance where you see that the comics are taking from a really potent popular vision of a character as opposed to the other way around. And with Terrence Stamp as Zod, it absolutely works. But even when you compare Terrence Stamp's vision of Zod with Michael Shannon's vision of Zod, there's not a significant amount of crossover, except if you look a little bit more subtly at how strongly Zod believes in himself and his people. Obviously, Man of Steel took it on a far more macro scale than Superman 2 was able to, because he basically has a almost eugenics-like vision of the superiority of the Kryptonian race versus humanity. But, you had to start somewhere, and Terrence Stamp's vision of Zod was a starting point for what we now understand Zod to be in any medium.
I mean, and by no means am I saying to me, you know, Terrence Stamp is the Zod of choosing if I had to choose. Obviously, in terms of live action, if I was picking my favorite, I'd pick Michael Shannon, just because.
Sure.
I thought that was one of the strongest. Villain portrayals in recent, you know, in the recent crop of superhero movies.
Amen. Yeah.
But I do appreciate what Stamp was doing, and there's no denying that it's had an effect on a medium in terms of comic books, and like you said, the animated series outside of the film that he was in. Jordan, what's your because I know you're controversial about it. Give us your hot take on the three Kryptonian villains. Go ahead.
Okay, I just started with my favorite part of this movie. They're my least favorite thing about this movie. I find these performances so cringeworthily bad. Whereas you guys read Terrence Stamp's voice when you read a comic book, I want to erase this from my memory if I could. As far as I'm concerned, Terrence Stamp is the voice of Jor-El, and that's it. And I'd take Mark Gibbons Zod, even though he only played him for like one scene and it wasn't even technically Zod, over this. Like, I find it so over the top. So I can't take it serious. Here's the thing. I can't take Gene Hackman's Luther seriously either, but at least he makes me laugh. Same thing with Richard Pryor in Superman 3. I can't take him seriously, but at least he makes me laugh. Whereas with Zod, it's like, it just makes me cringe.
All right. Well, let me ask you this, though, Jordan. When you get to the end of Superman 2 and Superman takes Zod's hand, how do you feel when you see that?
It kind of grossed me out, to be honest, because you hear the cracking.
That grosses That's how out, I feel. Really?
That's all?
Hearing
That's
the
all?
Crack in his hand, yeah.
Chris, it doesn't make you happy that he's kicking his ass?
Well, I mean, to be honest,
I've told you, Jordan, it's a weird bird. Now you're finding it out on your own.
I see where you're coming from. I see where you're going for with that, because I hate him so much that it would make me feel that way. But to be honest, I mean, I guess I'm happy he's gone at the end. But no, it's not like a. It didn't have that it didn't elicit that reaction from me that I guess I wish it would when Superman's kicking Zod's butt in Man of Steel, I'm like pumping my fist, like, yeah, during that whole Battle of Metropolis, like, I love it. But here I'm just like, I guess I am relieved. I'm relieved that he's off the screen and I don't have to see him again. So, sure, I'll give you that. I'll concede that.
You didn't even like Ursa? Come on, she was the most serious one of the three.
The performance,
some props, though.
That performance is not good, Adam.
That's where I disagree.
That performance is... it's. I'm sorry. There's something about it that I just can't. It's so Ursa, Azad's over the top. Ursa's performance is just so stale. Like it's, yeah. I'm sorry, Adam.
Okay, so there's no aspect of these three that you enjoy, basically. Is what you're driving.
Yeah, pretty much. Other than the fact that there's a Smallville connection.
Right. Yeah. Obviously, no. Yeah. And technically a Supergirl connection if you count,
she was Jinda Kal Ra's on recent Sarah right, Douglas yeah, recently. Yeah, so I liked her better in that than I liked her as Ursa.
Of course,
I'll say that.
I could have told you that you were. I could have predicted you that coming out of your mouth before you even said. But okay, so now obviously there's the confrontation between Superman and the three of them. You know, it's the crux of the third act. But just before that, we get to see Superman. You know, Clark in this case, with no powers, and I thought that whole scene with, you know, going to that diner and confronting that goof, you know, that bully, and basically Clark gets the crap beaten out of him. It was a little weird seeing at first, because we're so used to seeing Superman in the first movie and through half of this, just being, you know, Superman, and he never loses or anything. So it was a little bit, you know, it was a striking scene, you know, to see him bleed and seeing Christopher Reeve perform that, in the sense that, to me, and I think Zaki said this on our Superman the movie discussion when he brought this up, it's powerful because, and especially the way Christopher Reeve delivers it, because he's taking into account that Clark, Kal-El, however you want to phrase it, Superman, has grown up, all he's known is having these abilities. So now to experience the frailties of being human and to have such a reaction to seeing his own blood, I thought was a very powerful performance. And I thought, you know, the moment where Superman sees on the screen that, you know, Zod and the address from the White House, you really see a scene where Superman, for the first time, is really confronted with making a mistake. So a choice that he made, causing, you know, having, you know, dire consequences. And again, to me, it's some of the most powerful stuff in all four films, because it's just, I had never been, aside from, you know, Lois and Clark and Smallville to a degree. I'd never been used to seeing Superman, especially the first time I had watched these movies. I'd never been used to seeing Superman in that way. It's such a strong performance by Christopher Reeve in these scenes, I think. What was your take on that, Chris?
I think he did a great job with it. I'm not a big fan of this concept, though, overall, because, well, I mean, in general, I prefer subtlety over being beaten over the head with an idea.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and he was literally beaten over the head with the idea that he was now vulnerable.
Yeah, right.
But I really struggle to... I'm not the kind of person who watches a movie and tries to pick it apart by saying, well, they should have done this.
Sure.
However, with Superman, I tend to react a little bit differently because I have such a close relationship to the character. Right. But I would have preferred to see something that was a little quieter, like the fact that, wow, I feel cold in the snow. I cut myself when I went to pick up the salt shaker. Something that would have been a little bit more subtle. And then, you know, building up to the idea of getting your ass kicked. Okay, sure, maybe. But this scene overall and what follows at the end of the movie, I mean, I can appreciate it, especially for how much I enjoyed it as a kid. But nowadays... It's not the most elegant way to explore the idea that he's now vulnerable, although it does feed later to the scene where he does finally make it to the fortress and he's screaming in anguish to try and get his father to listen to him again, or his mother, depending on which version of the movie that you're watching. But overall, yeah, it does the job. I would have probably preferred to see something different, but considering the time in which this movie was released and the genre, it's fine. It's fine.
Now that you mentioned it about something more simpler or quiet, you know, like him getting the sniffles would have been something, or getting cut on something as simple as a salt shaker, like you said. I think that the thing that they really needed to hit home was the realization when he sees on the news, and you could have done this a different way of, oh crap, what have I done?
Right.
Right. And they could have explored that in a different way. So I'll agree with you there, but I did like my commentary was more specifically clear, not necessarily that I liked it, because I do have a problem with what he does later in the film to that same guy. What I was saying was more to the performance that Chris Reeve gave in those scenes.
You're never going to get me to talk down on Christopher Reeve's performance. I mean,
even
I think that
he was trying.
Absolutely. No. And I just wrote a piece at movies.com that defends Superman 4 because I prefer Superman 4 to 3, frankly. And
that's interesting. We may have to get you back for 4.
Hey, I'm all for it. You just let me know. But he brings it every time, and he brings the same level of dedication in each of the performances. And again, he is the prototype. Christopher Reeve as Superman is the prototype for a truly serious take and portrayal of a superhero character, of making those four color characters, those larger than life modern myths, those icons into actual flesh and blood. You're never going to get me to talk down about what Christopher Reeve has done for comic book cinema and specifically what he did for Superman.
Fair enough. Jordan, what was your take on that whole scenario where he goes to the diner, gets beat up, and then realizes that he's got to go back and try and get his powers back to combat Zod?
You know, believe it or not, I really like this scene.
See what I mean? He's the bizarro version of me on this podcast.
You know, on the old Modern Myth Media podcast, we had a guy named Bradley Lang, who's one of my favorite people in the world, but we had to give him the nickname the Contrarian. And you may be the heir apparent.
Can I borrow that?
Jamie Drewley from Holy Batcast calls me Bizarro Jamie.
Well, he's right. No, you are Bizarro in every sense of the word. Because, look, he likes Catwoman, Chris. That's all I'll say. The movie, not the character. The movie. But Go ahead. Before we get into that, before we devolve into arguing about that again, tell us.
Hey, well, you know, I love the character too. I'm just saying.
But I'm trying to emphasize the point of that movie. But anyway, let's.
But yeah, that movie.
Let's talk about. Continue. With your,
Yes. I wanted to bring up a Smallville reference, real quick, because I always do, and because Chris made me think of it, because he was talking about some subtler ways once Clark has lost his powers, and the episode of Smallville in season one where his powers get transferred to Eric Summers.
Oh yeah.
And you see Clark get a cramp, and it's a really funny scene, just seeing him suffer from you know, normal people problems, where they're running the bleachers at the gym, and then he goes back to the locker room and he doesn't know what a cramp is, and then he gets a cramp, and Pete has to explain it to him.
Yeah, true.
But anyway, I just that came to mind, especially since I just rewatched that episode just for a tease as part a preparation for our Smallville retrospectives that are coming up. But anyway, I thought I'd reference that. I really like this scene, though, and it's because it is one of the few scenes, maybe the only scene, I'd have to think about it more closely, but in this entire quadrilogy that I can 100% take seriously. Like, this scene is, it's not played for laughs at all. It's intense. It makes me, in the case, this is actually the opposite of with Zod, where I didn't have, like, any sort of emotional reaction to Superman defeating him at the end. In this scene, when Clark does go back at the end and beats this guy's ass, I was like cheering for him. I was like, yeah, this guy deserves it.
Of course, can't stand that scene and you love it. Why not? What else is new?
I had a similar. It wasn't quite as. I don't think it works quite as well, but as this other scene that I'm going to bring up, but. Another scene that's a similar is in Man of Steel when with the guy at the restaurant when he destroys his truck, and I was like pumping my fist at that. I was like, yeah, that guy deserved that.
Yeah, but this doesn't actively beat up a defenseless human being.
Okay, that's true. All I'm saying is this had gave me a similar feeling that scene in Man of Steel does. That's all I'm saying here. I'm just pumping my fist and watching that guy get what he deserves. I like the Man of Steel scene better, but I still really like these two scenes, I guess you could say, in Superman 2. Really, really seeing Clark. It's brutal. It is a brutal fight seeing him get beat up like that. And then when he sees on the TV, when he sees what's going on with Zod, and he realizes what he has to do, this is one of the most, in my opinion, this is one of the most like emotionally powerful scenes in this entire quadrilogy, if not the most emotionally resonant for me.
All right, so fair enough. But now before we get to the final battles, we got to get to the part where Clark does get his powers back. Now, I'm not going to make any defense of the theatrical cut here because it's far. I mean, we actually see it happen in the Donner cut, whereas in the theatrical cut, he goes, he makes that plea to both his parents, and then he picks up the green crystal, which as a child I confused with kryptonite, and he, you know, then it cuts away to another scene. In the Donner cut, we actually see it happen, and here's where I think Martin Brando's Jor-El has his most where his performance is the most powerful in this, I thought.
I agree.
Where he's basically, I mean, talk, Chris, take us away. Tell us, since you guys actually watched the Donner cut, tell us what's going on in this scene and basically, because I think it pays off some stuff that we saw in the first film. So if you wouldn't mind giving us a little bit of a lay of the land on what happened and your thoughts on it, Chris.
Well, again, it's that connective tissue, you know? I mean, it goes to the idea. This is a fundamental problem that I have with a lot of sequels that, you know, if they don't pay enough attention to the first films, it bugs the hell out of me. Like, a prime example is Batman to Batman Returns.
Okay.
Totally different movies. Different production designers, completely different sets, barely any mention of the events that preceded this movie, apparently. Same kind of thing with RoboCop 2 to RoboCop. I mean, it's very, very different philosophies that go into the makings of the movies. Sure. So
Scooby-Doo 2 to Scooby-Doo is one that I always like to reference with that.
It just, you hit the nail on the head. But
although, but I will, just to touch on it, I will argue, because I'm not a big fan of Batman 89, and I love Batman Returns, in that case, it works to my benefit in that situation.
See, you and I are going to have a severe difference of opinion here.
I enjoy Batman Returns, but I love 89. So
You guys both enjoy Batman Returns a lot more than I do then.
Yes, I know that. I know that, but at least I love 89, is what I'm saying.
Fair enough.
My sanity is still intact.
But either way, I mean, if you're going to call yourself a 2, then conceivably you have a connection to 1.
Correct.
And this is where I have a significant preference for the Richard Donner cut of Superman 2, because, you know, Jor-El is a very important part of the original movie, not just on Krypton. He helps his son find his true identity in multiple ways. And so it makes a significant amount of sense that it would be Jor-El who both passes judgment and who gives his son a second chance.
Sure.
to do the right thing.
Sure.
You know, I do have some fundamental issues with the idea that, okay, so you sent him to Earth, but you don't expect him to be with a human? That seems a little dispassionate to me.
Sure.
Yeah. But that's, you know, that's a larger fundamental issue that the movie doesn't concern itself with, so I put it aside. And I grew up on post-burn Superman in the comics, so right. You know, that just lends itself to it further. Yeah, but I mean, what Marlon Brando as Jor-El brings, first of all, the presence of Marlon Brando elevates the production exponentially, just because of the reputation that he has. Obviously, you know, he was the Godfather. Ilya Salkind called him basically God when he cast him as Jor-El first in Superman. So, and it gives more credence to the idea that, you know, Brando worked maybe 2.5 weeks on both movies, and he took home, I think it was a record at the time, like $3 million. I think that was the money that he took as his salary, but he also took a percentage of the gross. So he took home a lot of money from this, for all intents and purposes, a glorified cameo. But the role in Superman 2 makes it more than a glorified cameo.
Right.
And what he brings to the table beyond the connective tissue is the emotional resonance. Yes, I totally agree with you, Adam, that Lara, more often than not, is basically background dressing in the origin of Superman, particularly in the scenes that take place on Krypton, regardless of the portrayal of the origin. Right. She doesn't have enough to do. They gave her more to do in Man of Steel, which I appreciated, but she doesn't have as big a role as she should.
I could have spent another hour on Krypton in Man of Steel.
Oh, sure, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There's a wonderful conception of Krypton, and different and unique.
Yeah.
But what Jor-El brings to the table overall is that connection more than anything to destiny and to the larger idea of what Superman means and what he will do for the world, for his adopted world. So having Jor-El be the point man to both admonish his son for taking that step in his life, but to also be the one to say, look, you messed up. You know you messed up. I knew that you would probably make this choice, and I also anticipated that I would be able to give you this second chance.
Right.
That, to me, is one of the more emotionally resonant moments, when he's saying, look at me, Kal-El, look at me. He's trying to impart one last bit of wisdom onto his son before he makes a choice to try and actually save the world. So I don't think that that's quite something that you get with Susanna York's Lara, because she wasn't as important a part of the first movie, and they kind of tried to pigeonhole that into the theatrical version of the second movie when they decided to delete Brando's performance. So the emotional truth of that stuff and the clear talent of Marlon Brando as an actor, even though he was basically just reading his lines from around the set, he still was able to do it pretty well and better than most people. And it's that emotional truth that makes me bow to the superiority of having Jor-El in that spot.
And even I, well, one of the things that struck me, and I, you know, when I remember watching it, was you actually see Brando and Christopher Reeve on set together in the same shot, which is, you know, it adds so much
more
to the whole.
Oh, absolutely.
The whole scenario, and also it gives me more meaning to that dialogue. You know, you will see my life through your eyes, and I will see, you know, what I don't want to butcher the dialogue. But it adds so much more to that line of dialogue.
The extended version of the first movie, when, you know, he reaches out to hug his father his father just fades away. Then you see that tangible connection between them just ever so briefly.
Now they get that hug, and it's literally the last time that, Superman will get to talk to his father. Right? So. It was just blew me away, and I would honestly own the I mean, I do already, but if I didn't, I would recommend buying the Richard Donner cut for those scenes alone. Let alone the rest of it. Jordan, what's your take on because that's you've now just watched the Donner version for the first time. What's your take on that?
Yeah, you know, I'm largely in agreement with you guys, actually, for once.
Oh, sanity prevails for once within Jordan.
I'm not sure I'm quite as high on this scene as you guys are, but I do really like it, and I'll agree that it is one of the more emotionally resonant scenes in the quadrilogy. In fact, when I was talking about the other one being up there for me, I neglected to remember this one, which is in this very movie, which surprisingly I didn't remember it because I just watched this movie. But I would agree with you that this is as well. I really like it. And it actually, what makes it, what even elevates this scene is the way those lines, the really beautiful lines that Jor-El has. I love the way they're used in Superman Returns, which is actually a movie I like a lot better than this movie. But I think that actually retroactively adds a lot to the scenes in this movie, knowing what the significance of those lines in the following movie. I say the following movie, sort of, if you go by the Superman 2, Superman Returns continuity rather than going to Superman 3 and Superman 4. But you know what I'm saying.
Now we're getting into Terminator sort of timelines here.
We're getting into Legend of Zelda forking stuff is what we're doing. Yikes.
I really like this scene, and I would agree with what you guys said.
Awesome. So now we have to talk about, you know, the final battles. There are, I mean, it's the third act, but there are really two elements to it. It's the Metropolis battle, where Superman returns triumphantly. And, you know, to me, this scene, they paid homage to it on Supergirl, which I loved. But this scene is one of my all-time favorites, where Superman flies to the Daily Planet window, stops, crosses his arms, and says, "General, would you care to step outside?" I love that scene. I will unabashedly, you know, to me, you can show me any fancy special effect all you want is great, but that scene just gets me every time. And also, I think given that we're talking about 1980s special effects, I think that the battle in Metropolis in Superman 2 is quite good, very good, in fact. I love the fact that, you know, the three Kryptonians have the wherewithal to, you know, play on Superman's affinity for humanity and keeping them safe as a way to defeat him and as a way to get to him. I love that aspect of it. And just the in-air battles where you have, you know, holding Superman while Ursa goes to hit him and stuff. I think a lot of that, I'm going to give Zack Snyder some credit here and say he was paying some homage to the Chris Reeve movies when he had, you know, in the Metropolis or in the Smallville battle in his movie, where you had Non and or I guess that was Non, the big 9 foot tall, whatever he was, Kryptonian there, where he was holding Superman down as Ursa, you know. So I think there were some callbacks, which you know, if there were callbacks, I really appreciated them for that. But I love that you see that stuff here, and then also, you know, when that moment where the two Kryptonians, I think it was Ursa and Non again, they pick up the bus full of people and are about to throw it, and Superman's like, no, you know, think of the people, or whatever the case may be, and whatever the exact line of dialogue was, you know, all that stuff was just, I thought it was fantastic, and I ate it up. And then Superman, where all of a sudden, you know, has the forethought to say, okay, this is good. There's no scenario where this ends well. I need to take this battle away from Metropolis. And then he lures them to the fortress. I thought that was, and that's in no way a slight to Man of Steel, because everybody knows I really enjoy, I love Man of Steel. And I will counter that Superman was Superman for what, 2 weeks in that movie? By the time that, you know, so he doesn't have the same wherewithal that Christopher Reeve's version had in these moments. But and then when you do, so I loved the action heavy aspect of the Metropolis battle here. But then when you go back to the fortress, it's balanced by Superman's intelligence and ingenuity to sort of trick Zod and the other ones into thinking they are taking away his powers by sending him into that the Red Sun radiation chamber. Meanwhile, he's reversed the effect and used the chamber as protection for himself, and also depowering the three of them. I love the fact that in this movie, you get a bit of, you know, the Superman's brute strength, but also you get his intelligence. And I think sometimes in certain books and certain adaptations, Superman's intelligence is almost forgotten sometimes. So I really appreciated seeing it here. The one thing I couldn't stand, and one of my complaints in this movie, are, you know, first of all, that Saran wrap cellophane S thing that he throws at the Kryptonians, just
not in the Donner cut.
I know, thankfully, but in the theatrical cut, I cringe when I see it. And also, the other thing that makes me cringe is when the Kryptonians are given powers that they don't have. For instance, apparently Zod's heat vision can levitate a gun towards him, which in all the comics I've read is not possible. Nor is the laser finger thing, the trick that he had going. And I'm like, what is going on here? What are, like, look, I'm all for making, you know, changes to the story. Don't give me a straight adaptation. You know, I don't need a straight adaptation of one particular story. One of the things I think you should leave alone are Kryptonians' power sets. You know, those are kind of the sacred cows that you don't touch.
Well, they have. They have. To be fair, they have changed over that. I'm not saying I agree. I'm not saying I support these changes they made in this particular film. But they have changed over the years. I mean, when Superman was first conceived, he could only leap tall buildings in a single bound. He couldn't fly.
Sure.
So,
but I'm saying, and if you wanna make a movie.
Oh, come on! They should have kept the rebuilding Great Wall of China vision.
I wish I had that power. I could get done a lot faster. But look, there are certain allowances I'll make, but then there's ridiculousness. And those two examples I put forth, and the rebuilding of the Wall of China, which Chris mentions in jest, I think are ridiculous.
I agree.
Those are issues I have, but overall I enjoyed the final battle. So Chris, speak to the final battle and what your thoughts were of the Metropolis battle and then in the fortress.
Well, the Metropolis battle, it absolutely needs to be put in the context with the time. It was the first kind of superheroic downright fight that we had ever seen, you know, ever. And you know, by today's standards, it's a little slow, but you know, I think the effects actually hold up reasonably well, whether he's being thrown through a Marlboro truck or
product placement.
Right, yeah, weird product placement that would never be in a Superman movie today, right? Well, or
no.
There's a note. There's a note at the end of the credits that I noticed that says like the filmmakers do not endorse the use of tobacco or something like that.
But you know, also too, the Superman Richard Donner cut has the single overlooked punch that Superman throws in all four of these movies. Mm-hmm. And Superman Returns too. He didn't throw a punch in that movie. So,
2.5 hours of nothing. I love it.
But, no, I mean, this fight was revolutionary when it comes to comic book cinema. I mean, seeing one versus three, even today, is a pretty cool idea.
Right.
And obviously it was taken even further in the Smallville fight in Man of Steel.
Sure.
And certainly in several episodes of the Smallville TV show. But yeah, I mean, I still really enjoy watching this, whichever version. I mean, the fight is relatively unchanged from the theatrical cut to the Donner cut.
Sure.
And that's to its benefit. I really still enjoy watching this unfold significantly. I mean, you could tell that it was shot on a lot, and sure, I could have done without some of the more slapsticky stuff, like the guy in the phone booth, you know, still trying to stay on the phone. Like, really?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But overall, for what it is, and considering the time in which it was shot, I mean, this had to have been an extraordinarily complex thing to photograph.
Oh, sure.
And they do a pretty decent job with it, especially considering the you know, all the stuff that comes with the fact that it was shot in 1980, so, or 79, you know, thereabouts. So I still really enjoy the fight. Obviously, it doesn't hold a candle to what we're able to do in modern superhero fights, but you had to start somewhere, and that is a hell of a way to start.
Right. And do you agree with me with the about the fortress battle, and the fact that I love the balance between showing the forcefulness and the superpowers of Superman, but also having him use his brain, which I thought was nice.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, first of all, you know, setting the stage with "Would you care to step outside?" is still a very Superman thing to say.
Sure.
And I enjoy the hell out of that. But yeah, I mean, Superman's intelligence, you're absolutely right, does not get emphasized enough. I mean, in the Silver Age, he was trying to cure cancer.
Yeah.
And he was using his intellect in addition to the fact that he could, you know, leap tall buildings in a single bound and all of that stuff.
Right.
So yeah, having him pull one over on them because of the fact that he has a greater degree of knowledge with how the technology works and how the world works. Yeah, that's a nice way to emphasize the fact that he's super in more than one way.
Nice. Nicely put. Jordan, and I know you're going to you know, give heck to the effects because you can't put yourself in the 1980s. But can you at least appreciate the technical marvel and the accomplishment that it was to film such a scene?
I definitely respect how revolutionary this scene was in 1980. Absolutely. I mean, I understand that. I think Chris put it really eloquently that we wouldn't – that there needs to be a stepping stone. You know, that we can't get – you need to take a first step. We can't get – you put it much more eloquently. What did you say exactly, Chris?
See, this is why I bring people on, because they make us smart.
well, no. I mean, but you do have to start somewhere. I mean,
yeah.
can you imagine getting to, I guess, well, what's the intermediate example between Superman 2 and something like the Battle of New York? I guess it would probably be maybe the climax. Well, I mean, I shudder to mention it, but maybe the climax to something like Batman and Robin. Also pretty complex, even if the effect wasn't as strong. But really, you have to take that first step before you can fly, right? And I think it's a hell of a first step.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, and so I'll echo that sentiment in that I appreciate this scene in terms of, you know, it was a stepping stone to what we have now, I guess. But that being said, this, I don't care for this scene at all. Watching it, like, I, it just, this is one of those parts of the movie that just kind of bores me. I'm just like, and part of it's the effects part. I mean, it's just that it doesn't do anything for me. It's just, I mean, watching it in a 2018 context, I'm just like, whatever.
So now let me put it to you this way. Do you at least enjoy the fact that, that like we've been saying, Superman had to equally use his brawn, if you will, and his intelligence to overcome the threat?
Yeah, okay, I'll give you that. That's cool. That's cool. And the other thing I just want to point out is some of the differences here between the theatrical versus the Donner cut.
Yeah.
The ones that really stand out to me is, of course, the iconic general, "Would you care to step outside?" line is not in the Donner cut. It's a different line that he says. And then also there's, I know some of the slapstick elements have been cut out, Chris was mentioning the scene with the guy on the phone, like that's not there in the Donner cut. Yeah. And I think a few others from the Lester cut aren't there. So I think it's mostly the same, but yeah, there are some differences.
And the big difference is that when the in the theatrical, the Kryptonians fall into the abyss, and you assume that they are dead because that's all you're.
Oh yeah, I wasn't even getting. I was just talking about the fight in Metropolis. But yes. I was just thinking about the Metropolis fight. That too.
Yeah, because in the theatrical cut, you see them fall and that's it. You assume they're dead, but in the Donner cut, you see them being hauled off by, I guess it's the North Pole police department or whatever it is. I can't remember exactly. They had a name on their jacket, but I can't remember exactly what it was. They had a specific designation, but
wouldn't it have been cool if it was Argus?
Well, Argus wasn't. I don't think Argus was around.
I don't think so either. But would that not have been cool? Like
you would have to time travel there and get Richard Donner / Lester to put that in. But
Barry, where are you, Barry?
And if you're capable of doing that, go ahead. One of the other things that we have to talk about before we grade this thing is the actual endings of the movie, because they are very different. You see in both cases, Lois is struggling with the idea of having to maintain Superman and Clark's secret. Also, the intent is pretty much clear that if Superman is going to be Superman again, they cannot be together. All that is having a torturous effect on Lois's capability to function. So, in the theatrical cut, Superman and Clark decide that he is going to kiss Lois one last time, and said kiss is going to act like some sort of roofie, and just magically wipe her memories of. Now, see, here's where I'm not clear. What exactly does she not remember? Is it just in the theatrical cut? Maybe you guys can give me a clearer answer, because I don't have one. Is it just the fact that Clark is Superman, or is it the events of the entire movie? What does she not remember? Does anybody have an answer, Chris?
I think it's kind of amorphously defined. I mean, this is one of those things where, you know, it's kind of a blunt instrument in the way that it's employed in the story, because it's implied, at least in the Donner cut, maybe in the theatrical cut too. It's been a while. Honestly, it's been a while since I've watched the theatrical cut, but just because I tend to prefer the Donner cut whenever I throw it on. But, when she asks what's happening in the world, right, that would seem to imply that it was more than just the identity.
Right. So to me, it's like she forgot the events of the film.
Right.
Is that the case in the Donner cut? It was the conversely in the Donner cut. We get the turning the world, the turning time again by spinning, flying around the world. So in that one, it's pretty safe to say that the events of this movie are virtually null and void. Would that be Is that be a fair? Would that be a fair assessment? Like, put it this way, I don't like it. I wish they had a different ending for both.
Sure.
Because
yeah.
I don't like either. Because to me, in Nola, first of all, again, it's a power that Superman does not possess. Unless Booster Gold comes in and says, don't worry, I'll fix this for you. But not only that, I think it in a way nullifies the events of the movie we just watched. So all things being equal, I wish that somebody had come up with it. I know that when constructing the Donner cut, correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, you'll know more about this than I would, but the original intent was that the spinning the world, ending was supposed to be originally for two, and one was
yes.
to have a different ending, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to another problem of the production for the combined one and two, is that they ran out of time and they were going to have a different ending for the first movie, but they basically said, oh, we need something spectacular, hurry, come up with it. And it's like, well, we've got this turning the world backward ending for two, and the Salkinds were basically like, yeah, go do that one, just do it. And so they finished that, shoved it into the first movie, and we're going to come up with something different for the second movie. And obviously that fell on Richard Lester, but since it was the original conception for Superman 2 under Donner, he decided to put that back, including, that footage of Perry White getting ready to brush his teeth with a stogie in his mouth.
Yeah.
And
I will say I don't find the turning the world back around it's still bad. I don't find it as atrocious in this film as I do in Superman the movie. Just because it goes back to my whole gripe about resurrections, and that's not what Superman's doing in this movie, whereas it was what he was doing in Superman the movie. So that's what makes this one slightly less atrocious, in my eyes.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, like, to me, like I said, I wish both had a different ending, to be honest. One and like, I wish both versions of two had a different ending, if I had my way, because I don't really like either of them. If I had to choose, though, because I've already seen him turn the world back and do all that jazz, I'll take the theatrical ending, begrudgingly, but yeah, I just wish this had ended differently. And it's worth noting that it's a moot point afterwards, but there was a moment where he destroyed the fortress in
the Donner cut, yeah.
And then again, that didn't happen because he went back in time. But it is what it is. I wish these things would have ended differently, but there's nothing I can do to change it. So with that, let's give a grade for these things. We usually tend to go by a letter grade, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if you want to grade you just each cut differently, or if you want to grade Superman 2 as a whole, however you want to choose to do it, we'll follow your lead.
I'll do both. If I had to grade the theatrical version of Superman 2, I would probably give it a B and the Donner cut a B+. I don't think it quite makes it into A territory, even though I think it definitely has A elements to it. But taken as a whole, then that's probably I'm pretty comfortable giving it those two grades.
All right, Jordan, try and follow that suit if you can. What would
So Adam, I've finally gotten you to come around on letter grades.
I have no choice because over at Revenge of the Fans, where I write articles for Mario, they do letter grades. So I have.
Oh, okay. He converted you.
Yeah. So I kind of have to get used to it. So there we go.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. Well, I'm gonna give this. I'm gonna give one because it is the same grade for me for either cut.
Okay.
And that's a C for me.
Oh wow. I'm gonna be much more positive than Jordan. For the theatrical, I'm gonna lean with Chris and say a B. And then for the Donner cut, I'm going to say an A-.
All right.
because, like I said, when you watch the one and then you watch the Donner Cut of two, I think there's a payoff of some of the things that you see in one, and I really like that, and so I'm going to give it the little extra push of a grade than I did for Superman the movie. So that's
our more Otis would have gotten my grade up to C plus. Tell you that
the only time in the future I want to see Otis is when it's on the name of an elevator. That's Chris, before we get out of here, is there anything that you want to plug of yours that you want to?
Yeah, sure. So the day we're recording this, obviously, this is going to release later, but we're getting ready to watch the season finale of Star Trek Discovery.
Yes, I'm excited.
Me too, man. So we're going to have our season finale episode of Discovery Debrief, a Star Trek podcast that features me, my wife, Rachel, Zaki Hassan, who's been on the show before, and a friend of mine named Cicero Holmes, who's the co-host of an awesome video game podcast called Spawn on Me. We get together every week to discuss the new episodes of Star Trek Discovery. And since the season finale is coming up, we're going to review one of the tie-in novels that was recently released that's really good, called Drastic Measures. And I'm also developing the next episode of my podcast, Comics on Consoles, that deals specifically with comics-based video games. And the next game that I'm going to tackle is the 2008 Iron Man game, developed by Sega, or it was actually developed by Secret Level and published by Sega. And so that's going to be coming up hopefully pretty soon here. And then, keep an eye out for appearances that I might make on the Batman on Film podcast, and follow me on Twitter at Chris Clow.
Awesome. Jordan, if anybody wants to follow you and talk about Thirst or whatever else you love that nobody else does, where can they do that?
I'll say before I give my social media, I'll just say I mentioned this a while back that I did an episode that I was a guest on the Batman and Robin Eternal podcast with Rob Myers and Terrence O'Neill.
Sure.
We actually did a two-parter, so the second part of that episode is now out as well. And so it'll be out for a while by the time this episode comes out, but I thought I'd make sure to mention it anyway. And then if you want to find me on Twitter, and I guess I should say what we talked about too, right? Looking ahead to 2018 in DC, so what we're looking forward to.
Cool.
It was fun. It was a lot of fun. And I, if you're listening, Robert Terrence, thanks for having me on again. You can find me on Twitter or on Instagram at BatFanJordanV.
And if you want to find me, it's at Superhero Sci-Fi on Twitter. Chris, once again, thank you for coming on. We really appreciated it.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been fun.
That you'll come back, and because we do have some Star Trek and Green Lantern crossovers that I'd love to pick your brain about on the show, and we can also educate Jordan about some Star Trek here, because he's not a follower of the franchise. Another one is false, but we'll try and fix that. So we'll hope you come back, and we'll also have you on for something Batman related too, so we can talk about the Dark Knight as well.
Sounds like a blast. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.
Until then, everybody, have a wonderful weekend and a wonderful week. So long, everybody.
Bye-bye.
See ya.